Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday before the Christmas holiday. Lieutenant Governor-elect Mandela Barnes has been traveling across the state with Governor-elect Tony Evers to hold listening sessions on the next two-year state budget. Barnes stopped in Superior on Monday, and he spoke with me by phone about the feedback they've been getting from citizens across Wisconsin.
People talked about education. People talked about the environment and health care. I mean, the thing is, whether it's schools that aren't being funded adequately, or whether it's resources that aren't being properly allocated towards students with special needs, whatever the case may be. I mean, I think that is that's the biggest feedback overall, even from the Green Bay listening session. And so then environmental concerns as well, making sure that there is funding to alleviate any issues, whether it's water remediation, air quality issues. That has been a recurring theme. I actually missed the Wausau session. So I was at the Green Bay, missed Wausau, and then Superior yesterday. And it's been the same thing. It's been the same things that people are concerned about. And I imagine we will still hear more of what people have been looking for that they've been missing for the last 8 years.
Well, when you heard from people in Superior, did you hear any issues that were specific to northern Wisconsin?
Issues specific to northern Wisconsin, I guess I would say a lot of it deals with having a more sparse population, making sure that there is money to, whether it's to have access to health care, because who knows how far you may have to travel to see a physician, even if you have health insurance. A lot of the education funding, just given the way that the structure is set up, some schools are missing out on, what they could have if there was a larger, more concentrated population. So mostly, what we've been getting and what we've been trying to craft the budget is being very specific and intentional about how we address the specific needs of each community, and that's why we're going all over the place.
Well, and so that's why you're holding these budget listening sessions across the state?
Oh, absolutely. We want to have as much input from people going into January. We haven't even taken office yet, but it's important for us to, be ready to go on day one so that we can craft the most equitable budget for the people of Wisconsin. And, I don't know the last time that there's been input at this level. And, I mean, the response has been incredible. People sign up, RSVP, we're getting, we're packing out the rooms, and people are, people feel comfortable. People feel like they have access, and which they absolutely do, and are actually having a say-so in how this budget should be crafted. For the last 8 years, that hasn't been the case. And the fact is, when we can provide that input versus, what the donors or what more influential lobbyists suggest should be in the budget, I think we're all better off for it this way, because this will be a real budget crafted by people of the state of Wisconsin.
So you definitely think that the feedback that you're getting is going to impact what you see as priorities in the next budget, you and Governor-elect Evers?
Absolutely. And I also left out mass transportation, which is another one that comes up a lot. Superior, they talked about how, the bus lines end at 7 p.m. as if people don't get off work after 7 p.m. People's input will absolutely be the number one consideration in this budget. We're not traveling around the state for no reason. We want to make sure that we are getting the most comprehensive guidance that we possibly can from the people who will be directly impacted by the budget.
Well, and I guess it's no surprise that Governor-elect Evers has identified education as a top priority in the next two-year state budget, given that he's the state school superintendent. But what are the priorities that both you and him have identified for the next two-year state budget?
Absolutely. Access to health care. The education piece can't be understated enough just because of everything else that goes along with it. And also, looking at other areas where we're spending too much money, like incarceration, like we're putting too many people behind bars in the state of Wisconsin, and we have to get that under control so that we can free up funding for other programs, so we can have money that can go towards education, money that can help fund our mass transportation infrastructure. The environmental protection piece and working to create living wage jobs, which, I think we've been doing it wrong for the last 8 years. You can't subsidize your way into a living wage job state. You have to make sure that you create the framework that attracts higher wage employers, meaning that, again, you invest in education, invest in higher education as well, making sure that the transportation infrastructure is there so that people can get to and from the job. That's what the largest employers are attracted to. Those are the areas that people are looking to move their business. So we have a lot of work to do in that regard as far as upfront investment.
So, you know, there has obviously been a lot of changes in the last couple of weeks with the extraordinary session. There's been attempts to rein in the power of Governor-elect Evers and the Attorney General-elect, Josh Call. Some of the things that Evers identified on the campaign trail, like the job creation agency WEDIC and doing away with that, now he won't have any say over that board until 9 months into his term. I guess I'm just wondering if you have any insight into his mind of whether or not he'd like to see that agency still continue, or if he plans to do away with it once he has more of a say.
And even on the campaign trail, he talked about restructuring of the organization. We should absolutely have an economic development agency with the state. But we need to have one that actually, again, works for the people. What we have is a quasi-governmental entity, but the state has been putting the largest share into it, oftentimes not even having the outputs that we should have or the accountability that the people of the state of Wisconsin deserve. So going back to the commerce model is one suggestion that Governor-elect Evers talked about on the campaign trail, which would make the most sense. So provide that accountability. We would have actual metrics. And not only did they take away the appointing authority for that first 9 months, they also changed the way that people receiving support from WEDIC have to report their numbers and report their data, which diminishes the already waning level of accountability that they exhibit in the first place.
Well, and other things that Governor-elect Evers identified during the campaign trail was that he'd like to see around $1.4 billion for education. And some Republicans have come out and said that that is way too high of a number, considering other needs within the next two-year budget. Do you see there being any compromise on that, or do you expect Governor-elect Evers to stick with that number?
Well, education is the most critical funding, is the most critical line item in a state budget. Again, like I said, it has so many longer-lasting consequences when it comes to our children, making sure that they have the best education possible, making sure that they have the access that they need. And the state has a commitment to two-thirds funding for our public schools. We just want to restore that commitment that the state has already made. The fact is, so much money has been cut from our public schools that we haven't been there in a long time, and us getting back to the place that we should be seems to them, they want to paint it as radical, and this is what the state should be doing in the first place.
Well, and I'd just like to get your thoughts too, Lieutenant Governor-elect, on the lawsuit that was filed just the other day by liberal groups over the restrictions on early voting that were passed in the extraordinary session. What do you think about that legal challenge?
Well, I think it's a necessary legal challenge. There was a legal challenge that got us, that got the state of Wisconsin the extra time for people to early vote. This is about making sure that it doesn't matter what part of the state you live in, what your job situation is, what your family situation is, that you have a chance to cast a ballot. It's something that's worked. And this is totally vindictive because you look at a Speaker Voss who said that if you took Milwaukee and Dane County, or if you took Dane County and the city of Milwaukee out of the equation, Governor Walker would have won re-election. Well, that just means that he doesn't think that the votes from Dane County or the city of Milwaukee count like the rest of the votes across the state. And this is an effort to limit that vote because the ideas that they presented have been rejected by the people of the state of Wisconsin soundly. And not only that, you look at the unfair maps that the majority is built upon. This is only to aggrandize and to consolidate power instead of doing the work that the people elected us to do, giving us the opportunity to do the work that the people elected us to do. It's about silencing the voice of the two largest metropolitan areas in the city, and on election night, during the election, post election, we've talked about making sure that this state works together, making sure that we are unified, making sure that we come together to provide solutions. Not this vindictive style of governing, because it doesn't work for anyone. it's what was rejected on November 6th.
Well, what do you say to Republicans like Representative John Nygren or State Senator Tom Tiffany, who have argued that it's unfair for urban areas to have more time for early voting, whereas rural areas don't have that same kind of opportunity?
Well, that's the thing. They could have that time. It's up to the municipalities.
Well, their argument is that there are there's less funding in rural areas, and that some town or city clerks are only there part of the week because of the restrictions on budgets and staffing and things like that.
Well, if that's the case, John Nygren, who is the co-chair of the Joint Committee on Finance, he has an opportunity to make sure that there is funding, to make sure that there's access to the ballot for people in areas that may feel like they don't have the opportunity to cast an early vote the way that other parts of the state would. And I don't ever recall him bringing that up as a concern.
Well, I guess, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about your role, working with Governor-elect Evers. What do you see as your position in the new administration, and how are you helping to work on or craft the next two-year state budget?
Yep, I want to be helpful, and with Governor-elect Evers' agenda, I want to make sure that we are reaching as many people as possible the same way we did with the campaign. But this time, when it comes to governing, because so often you go around and people just don't know what's going on. So for the budget process, I want to make sure that I'm going around being a salesperson for Governor-elect Evers' budget, making sure that people, again, one, that we're getting the input, two, people know what's in there, and especially in parts of the state that aren't represented by someone in the legislature who is more amicable to the budget. We need to make sure that in those areas, people understand what their representatives may or may not be voting for, and to also realize that their representatives could potentially be voting totally counter to their interests, totally counter to the things that they think are important. But beyond that, I want to make sure that we move this state in the direction of equity and sustainability, making sure that we're creating an economy that works for everyone, making sure that we are creating an economy that lasts for the next generation and even longer, long-term job growth, long-term solutions to the problems that the state is faced with. The equity piece, as you know, we're home to some of the largest disparities along racial lines, gender lines, generational lines as well. The economy that exists for people my age is in many ways worse than it was for people for my grandfather when he first moved to Wisconsin. So we have to fix those issues. I want to make sure that Wisconsin is a state that is headed towards the future.
Again, you were just listening to Lieutenant Governor-elect Mandela Barnes. He stopped in Superior this week as part of budget listening sessions across the state. Barnes also spoke with People of Color host Henry Banks for an upcoming program. You can hear People of Color on Thursday evenings at 6 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we turn to a new study from the Science Advisory Board for the International Joint Commission. It identified 15 sites on the Great Lakes that are most vulnerable to crude oil spills. The IJC is a U.S.-Canadian group that assesses progress by the two nations to restore and protect the Great Lakes under the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. The commission investigates a range of issues based on goals to enhance water quality and prevent harm to the lakes. Michael Murray is lead author of the study and a staff scientist with the Great Lakes Office of the National Wildlife Federation. He spoke with me recently about their findings and recommendations for decision makers around the lakes.
The IJC, International Joint Commission, has had an interest in the issues of potential oil spills in the Great Lakes for a number of years. IJC did a report back in 2006 looking at potential impacts of spills, in particular focus on the Huron Erie corridor, say from St. Clair River, Detroit River. And so they've had a longstanding interest in this. And then I think the interest has increased more recently just because, in particular, of all of the oil production, the increased oil production that we're seeing in North America, and both in Canada, especially Western Canada, and in the U.S., in particular, kind of the north central U.S., Dakotas, and North Dakota, Montana, and then Western U.S. And so in general, a lot of that oil that gets produced is then transported. A lot of that crude oil gets transported to the east, either towards, you know, maybe for export or for use in the Great Lakes Basin or beyond, or say down to the Gulf of Mexico for processing, refining, and possibly export. So a lot of that oil is coming kind of through the Great Lakes or near the Great Lakes, and given that, there is an interest in exploring this, the potential risks that can occur with oil spills, just because we know, you know, in spite of the best of efforts by companies and so on, there are occasionally going to be spills, and we've had some large spills historically, in particular in marine systems, and then the large spill in the Kalamazoo River back in 2010. And so just given all of that, there was an interest in exploring this issue around the potential ecological impacts that could occur with oil spills in the region.
Okay. And so you've gone through this report and you've identified a number of vulnerable areas across the Great Lakes that were either intersects with pipeline corridors or rail that travels along the basin. So what are some of the most vulnerable areas that you have identified in this report?
Well, it's a good question. As you just alluded to there, we actually worked with the company Linotech in doing this assessment. And so basically there were really two key issues to look at. One was just the presence of sensitive habitats. And often, as in, you know, like a lot of ecosystems, often kind of coastal shoreline areas that are particularly sensitive, particularly important ecologically with coastal wetlands and spawning sites for fish. And so on. So those areas in general are quite important. And then also, as you mentioned, the fact that we've got oil that's transported nearby is another issue too. So if we have the sensitive area plus the oil nearby and potentially spilling nearby, then those are two key factors, obviously, in terms of identifying vulnerable areas. So that's what Linotech did in this assessment. And so that's how they came up with the 15 more vulnerable areas in the basin. And again, they're all generally kind of near shore areas, say Duluth Superior Harbor or up at the Straits of Mackinac, where we have the twin pipelines going through the water, the Line 5, Enbridge Line 5. We've got Saginaw Bay with pipeline passing close to there. As I already mentioned earlier, the Huron Erie corridor, actually a couple areas, and including Western Lake Erie, that's considered to be vulnerable as well. You know, really important ecologically there. Coastal wetlands, a lot of which have been degraded already historically. So then, once there's a spill, you know, have the potential for yet further degradation. And then other areas, both in the eastern part of the basin, in Eastern Lake Erie, and in Lake Ontario as well, that are vulnerable. So it's really these shoreline areas that are partly, you know, just very important ecologically, and sometimes even for human use and with fisheries and so on, say in Western Lake Erie, but also where we coincidentally, in many cases, have this oil transport infrastructure there that, if there are problems with spills, then we can have impacts in those areas that can be pretty, you know, significant and possibly, you know, persist over longer times.
And so my understanding is that this doesn't identify it identifies the most vulnerable sites, but it doesn't say which ones are kind of more at risk than the others.
Correct. Right. It was more of kind of a qualitative assessment. So based on the analysis, the Limnotech and we decided these 15 sites in aggregate are important areas that are at risk. But there was no, it didn't entail more quantitative analysis where we might dive a little bit deeper in the specific, you know, habitat characteristics, specific species present in a particular area, potential for the oil to maybe, you know, persist longer, to be more challenging to clean up. You know, in particular, when you have spills in wetlands areas, it can be challenging to address those, just because of the activities you take to respond might actually cause some problems on their own. Just sending in heavy equipment into more fragile wetlands can be a problem. So we didn't, you know, kind of dive into those kinds of of details at which you would need to do a little bit more quantitative assessment to try to say rank the 15 sites from most vulnerable to less vulnerable. But in general, we considered all 15 of them to be relatively vulnerable. And also, just to follow on that too, that kind of points to more information needs that we have, both concerning making sure that we have pretty current information on the habitats and conditions of habitats in these different areas, as well as different species that are present. We know there've been a lot of changes in the lakes that have occurred over the past couple decades, and in particular with some invasive species coming in, all the zebra mussels, quagga mussels, and so on, and they've really altered the, kind of a lot of the bottom of the lakes, a lot of the substrate, a lot of the habitat in a number of areas. And so it's important that, we have kind of current assessments of the condition of habitat around the lakes. And some of that work has been done, but I think more needs to be done. And with that information, it will be a little bit easier to do a kind of a quantitative analysis following up on what we did in this study.
So what were some of the key findings then, or recommendations that came about as part of this study?
Well, for one thing, I think some of the key recommendations are what we were just touching on there in terms of the vulnerable areas. And they're, again, they tend to be in the, kind of near shore, shoreline, coastal areas of the lakes. So that, that has implications for just kind of our current infrastructure, pipeline infrastructure, or oil transport infrastructure, but also just going forward where we might, site pipelines in general going forward. I mean, if an area is particularly vulnerable, and maybe doesn't have significant pipeline infrastructure now or as significant, then it might argue that potentially other options for transporting oil are preferred to try to avoid a particular area. But also we indicated a number of areas where we need more research. A lot of the research that has been done on oil spill impacts has been more in marine systems, with the Exxon Valdez and the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and a lot less work in freshwater systems. Fortunately, we had some that came out of the Kalamazoo River spill back in 2010, very significant spill there, and a lot of research on ecological impacts of that. But fortunately, we haven't had other major spills in the Great Lakes, but there have been some spills, including other types of petroleum products, refined products, not necessarily crude oil, where there have been studies that have done. But we definitely need more information on the ecological risks of oil spills in the Great Lakes, including to the types of species that are more common, the walleye and lake trout and so on, that might be potentially affected by oil spills. So there's definitely more work needs to be done on those. There's been a lot of work on, say, modeling, what might happen to oil that's spilled, say, up in the Straits of Mackinac. And still, I think, we could benefit from, further modeling, but also consideration of spills in some of the other areas of the lakes that haven't been studied as much. What might, the fate of the oil be, is, say, if it was spilled in Western Lake Erie or Detroit, Detroit River, St. Clair, or St. Clair River, those areas, what potential, fate might be. And then, again, just, much more information is needed on ecological sensitivity, different effects on different species, fish species, in particular the early life stages, which are particularly vulnerable to oil and to oil components. And also, just to add one other thing to them, the different types of oil. We're seeing a lot of the oil production in the West, in particular in Canada, is from the oil sands, tar sands. And so then that gets processed, diluted before it gets transported. And that that type of oil, when it's transported, and then if it spills, it's often going to respond a little bit differently in the environment than, say, some of the lighter crude oils. So just having more information on that, on the fate of that oil and the components in it, and how any potential different ecological risks with that oil compared to, say, the more standard light oil, that would be useful as well. There is more research going on in that area, but I think we would still benefit from yet more work.
Again, you were just listening to Michael Murray, staff scientist with the Great Lakes Office of the National Wildlife Federation. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we hear from Hope McLeod. She is a reporter, poet, songwriter, and now author of the new book, Have I Got a Story for You? The book is a collection of 35 stories she wrote during her time as a reporter for the Bayfield County Journal and Ashland Daily Press. McLeod spoke with me by phone this week about why she decided to publish those stories in her new book.
The origin really is the 35 stories that were part of my entire body of work for the Bayfield County Journal, which included 749 feature stories over 6 years. And the reason I put this collection together is duofold. I made a decision to leave the paper last December on the 24th, and I wanted to honor that time in my life, a transition out of a group corporate setting into freelance writing, which has been a dream of mine. And I quite honestly would not have taken that step if it weren't for the inspiration I got from the people in these stories. And so I handpicked 35 stories that really inspired me, that surprised me when I interviewed these people and changed me one story at a time. And so I wanted to do this for that honoring. But it's also inspiration that I wanted to share with other people at various stages in their life. It may help them even catapult to a new doorway to something unexpected in their lives. And I needed to walk through a new doorway. I was pretty stressed out, and some things happened to me health-wise and personally in my family that made it difficult to just continue at, you know, that level that I'm talking about. It's very intense, and you live and breathe journalism every day. I live and breathe storytelling every day as a freelance writer, but it has a completely different quality to it now, and this is just one new income stream, one new focus out of a half dozen that I've been nurturing this year.
Well, I was reading over a lot of the stories that you've selected in Have I Got a Story for You, and a lot of them seem to be profiles of people who are living in the region, oftentimes who have struggled with loss of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the examples that you have in your book was the story of Hannah Stonehouse Hudson and the loss of her husband, and also Kelsey Peterson, who suffered a spinal cord injury, and who was a dancer before that, and,
right,
you know, lost a big part of her life that way. What do some of these stories that kind of focus on, you know, people who have experienced loss, what lessons have you drawn from them, and what do you hope people take away from that?
The emotional takeaways are the survivors, the people that live beyond these losses, like Kelsey struggling with the loss of her body. She was a dancer. She was a gorgeous dancer and a yoga teacher. And her spirit is unbelievable. I just love talking to this woman, being in her presence. And she doesn't have all the answers, but man, she's trying to find out how to cure paralysis. Is that possible? Everyone says, or a lot of people say, you've got to be kidding. Your journey is foolhardy. But the cure map, this trip that she has been taking with her filmmaker buddy across country, is just exemplary of how someone has taken that loss to a new level of pursuit and self-exploration. It's powerful stuff. Same with Lori Schneider, MS, climbing 7 of the tallest mountains in the world, and that's not all she's done. Just remarkable women. So I hope people, those are my personal lessons, are, okay, why am I sniveling with a pebble in my shoe? You know, I use that line in that Lori Snyder story, and it's like, come on, Hope. There's got to be another way to do this. And we all have losses. It's universal.
Well, it kind of flips the narrative, right? I mean, people kind of assume that if something were to happen in them in life, that would be the worst thing that could ever happen to them. And in a lot of these situations with the stories that you mentioned, you know, Hannah and Lori and Kelsey, they've turned or transformed tragedy into triumph.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah, and a lot of people are having to do that these days. I was just reading a story this morning of a woman in Florida who recently lost her home. She's retired, had just retired to Florida, and boom, house gone in that hurricane. Sitting on a stump on her empty lot now saying, what am I going to do? And at one point, all of the characters in my book were at that place. That pivotal place of, do I go down the woe is me tunnel or do I transform?
You just have a interesting collection of stories here because it not only do people have stories of, you know, loss or lessons that they derive from that, but you also have people who are breaking barriers, whether, you know, it's through renewable energy and trying to encourage more use of alternative energy in the Shawangan Bay region, like with Bill Bailey and his wife, or, you know, also with Claire Hintz, who is a woman farmer. And, you know, I think we heard something this year that we're seeing more women farmers here in Wisconsin.
Yes, real groundbreakers. And Bill Bailey and Gail Chatfield with their solar energy programs. Unbelievable what's happening. The state of Wisconsin, we have surpassed every county. Bayfield County is now the most lit up solar county in the state. I mean, we have 85 solar group by participants. So, you know, when I wrote this story about Bill Bailey and Gail Chatfield, they were just beginning this journey. I mean, just a year previous, they had turned their commercial greenhouse business into a business run by renewable energies, both solar energy and fired furnaces. And it was an experiment. And now, 5 years later, those guys are lighting up the Shawangan Bay, literally. And they volunteer. They don't get paid. It's just, there's something in the water here. Everyone jokes about that, but it's true. There's a unique atmosphere here, and whether it's because we're the northernmost point of Wisconsin before you cross the water to Canada, I don't know. You've lived here, you know.
Yeah, well, and several of your stories talk about the inspiration that artists or photographers draw from this place and this region and how it inspires them to create art or, you know, I guess play with new expressions of that.
Mm-hmm. Lake Superior.
Yeah, you know, Leonarda, is it Bowden?
Bowden.
Yeah, she was one of the artists that you wrote a story about in Have I Got a Story for You, and she talked about the area being the third coast. Yeah. So what is it about this place that inspires you to write stories about them or that, you know, these people have lives that are remarkable enough to warrant stories about them?
Well, you know, I suppose there are hundreds of enclaves like the Shawangan Bay area, where anyone, if they listen deeply and long enough, will find similar stories, similar people. I don't want to pound my chest and say this is the place to live, because we don't want that. We don't want everybody to move here. But I have, I guess, honed a particular skill to be able to figure out these stories because I'm a storyteller and I have told stories all my life and from songs to poems to short stories to nonfiction, journalism, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm always looking for a story, and they found their way to me once word got around. And I'll tell you, I never tired of the types of stories that would come my way. People tugging my sleeve at IGA, you know, have I got a story for you? That's where it came from. I could continue on for many stories henceforth, and I will. I'm not exactly sure what form it's going to take next round, but this is opening a new door. That's why I love the photo on the cover with this door that just invites the reader to try something new. Go somewhere you've never been before for a few hours. I got to do it for 6 years.
Well, and you've called this collection of stories, too, Hope, a keepsake for the community. Why did you want that? Why did you want to preserve these stories in a book rather than just leaving them to the newspaper records?
Yeah. Part of it is my loyalty to the older generation. God bless their hearts. They were avid County Journal readers. And they've been heartbroken since the loss of those stories. And quite frankly, I don't know what the percentage is. It's somewhere around 65% of Bayfield County residents are retirees at large amount. And so these are strong readers and engaged citizens volunteering, doing this and that to keep the community alive and thriving. And I really wanted to honor them so that their stories were preserved and they could pass them on to their children and grandchildren, because they belong to them. You know, I got to tell them, but they gave them to me freely. So it's a gift to them. And as was my book signing on November 17th at Harborview Event Center. I invited everyone in the story to have a story display booth to show off what they do in the community. It was unbelievable. There was so much joy and community celebration, and it was Disneyland for me. My stories came to life, and all these people started making new bonds and new plans for whatever creative adventure they're walking into for the next year. So it was pretty exciting.
Well, I think that's one of the great things about storytelling is creating bonds between people, whether you meet them or not, through writing.
Exactly. I walk away now. This is maybe something making. It's also something I can use as a teaching tool. I started teaching journalism. I taught 8 preview journalism classes at the Washburn Public School in October, early November. And this may open up into an accredited class in the future. And I was thinking I could use this as reading material, maybe not the sole text, but to get kids excited about local stories. You know, everybody wants to leave home and join the big newspaper, but it's really important to keep local journalism alive and the stories of each other and to create those bonds of community, so that's what journalism's for historically. The newspapers were like lean-tos for communities to learn about the dangers out there. But journalism is really important, and it's been getting a bad name in some circles. And I want to bring it back home to the heart of journalism. And so it can serve that purpose as well, I'm hoping.
Again, you were just listening to freelance writer and author Hope McLeod. She lives in Washburn, and Have I Got a Story for You can be found at the Apostle Islands Booksellers in Bayfield, Shawamigan Books in Washburn, Redberry Books in Cable, and the Art Dock at the DeWitt Sites Building in Duluth. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll review news of the week. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio, and up next, we take a look back on some of the news of the week. Firefighters responded Monday to a fire at a decommissioned Twin Ports grain elevator. Dan Crocker with our partner Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Three employees from a salvage company based in Green Bay, Wisconsin, were reclaiming old lumber from the inside of the elevator when the blaze started. Superior Fire Battalion Chief Scott Gordon says a spark from one of their cutting tools started the fire. Millions of dollars in salvage equipment, including a large crane, were destroyed. Gordon says the owner of the elevator lost about $450,000 worth of reclaimed lumber that had already been sold. The 150-foot-tall grain elevator was built in the late 1800s with old-growth white pine trees logged from northern Minnesota and Wisconsin.
That was Dan Crocker with NPR News reporting. The Superior Fire Department estimates the fire caused around $2.5 million in damage. Around 200 union workers were on strike this week since contract negotiations failed with a northern Wisconsin manufacturing company. The union wants to see better wages and health care for its members. Union members say the contract offered by CG Breading Manufacturing Company in Ashland doesn't give workers enough to make a decent living. That's according to Todd Humlecker. He's a Wisconsin business representative with District 10 of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. Humlecker says the company has shown no interest in continuing negotiations.
Strikes don't help anybody, but we need to be able to get back to the table and come to an agreement so everybody can get back to work.
The company told KBJR-TV that take-home pay has increased more than health care costs over the past 4 years. The company said it was offering wage increases ranging from 2.5% to 3% in each year of a 3-year contract. Humlecker says that wouldn't keep pace with inflation or rising insurance premiums. The State Natural Resources Board has reconsidered an emergency rule for commercial fishing on Lake Superior. A majority of board members voted to table the rule in order to gather more information about its impacts to the lake ecosystem and stakeholders. Last week, the board voted to accept the emergency rule. The decision put into practice a new agreement between the State Department of Natural Resources and two Native American tribes. But Natural Resources Board member Dr. Fred Prain says there are too many unanswered questions related to the rule.
Particularly the biological effects that this has on all resources up in the Lake Superior region.
Prain requested the DNR gather information on a quota for all affected species, including the survival rate of other fish that are caught while harvesting, lake trout or whitefish. He also asked for more information about the effects the rule would have on sport fishing and legal questions surrounding the fishing agreement between the tribes and state. The DNR's negotiations with tribes has been largely confidential. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has signed off on the three final state permits sought by the developers of the planned PolyMet copper-nickel mine in northeastern Minnesota. The Department of Natural Resources last month granted PolyMet the key permit for the project, a permit to mine. PolyMet would be the state's first copper-nickel mine. Critics of the open-pit mine near Babbitt cite the risks of acid mine drainage and dam safety concerns. PolyMet says it can operate without harming the environment while providing hundreds of jobs. Opponents of Enbridge Energy's plan to replace its aging Line 3 crude oil pipeline across northern Minnesota to Superior have filed appeals to challenge the State Public Utilities Commission's approval of the project. Environmental and tribal groups filed initial notices on Wednesday with the Minnesota Court of Appeals against the commission's decision to grant a certificate of need for the project. Filing a joint appeal were the Red Lake and White Earth Ojibwe tribes, Honor the Earth, and the Sierra Club. Also filing was Friends of the Headwaters. Enbridge says Line 3 is the most studied pipeline project in Minnesota history and that it believes the courts will reaffirm the PUC's decisions. This time of year is commonly referred to as the season of giving. Some people are volunteering their time, while others are donating money to worthy causes or those who are less fortunate. Reporter Olivia Shalaby recently stopped at the Salvation Army's Red Kettles in Superior to talk with bell ringers and community members about what the season of giving means to them.
My name's Anthony Smeltzer. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'm currently bell ringing at a Walmart in Superior, Wisconsin. I'm 24. I moved out here when I was 18 after my dad retired from the Culinary Union in Las Vegas. And I have some family up here. I go to the Salvation Army every Sunday for church, and I'm close with the pastor there. So they ask if people, they needed people, and I volunteered. I'm doing it for a good cause, and I can see different people around the community and have a good couple words with them. I have been helped by Salvation Army multiple times this year, from being homeless, staying at a shelter, to where I am right now with my apartment. They've really helped me out through it all. The majority of the community is very nice. When I greet someone, most of the time, they'll give me a response. Some other people that aren't in a good mood, sometimes I try to compliment them on something that they're wearing or, you know, something like that. And have a good little conversation, so maybe they go into Walmart or leave Walmart a little happier than they did before. Most of the people are really caring, and most people actually donate.
I'm Jill Toonhorst. I think that we're all human beings in this world. We're all here to help each other, and I don't know, I'm kind of a half glass half full person, so I think that we need to share.
I'm from Las Vegas, so I'm so used to the heat. As far as the cold goes, I layer up. I'm wearing long johns on top of my dress pants right now, and I currently have 5 layers between shirts and sweatshirts and jackets on. And mittens. Mittens are a must.
I think sometimes it's easy to get caught up in your own world and not look outside yourself. It makes you feel good to give back to other people that don't have as much as you do. And actually, I put a little change in there, but my residents from New Perspective Senior Living also gathered up change, and so that was from all of us.
It makes me feel better about the community, but as far as humanity in general goes, I know that this money is going towards people that need help, so I know I'm doing a good thing.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Lastly, we leave you with some final thoughts from Rachel Brown. She's a journalism student at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. And she shared this story with us about her experience one morning while grabbing a cup of coffee at Starbucks in Duluth.
As I'm sitting at a Starbucks, writing my final case study before winter break, I was reminded about the true meaning of humanity in the holiday season. I'm nestled up next to the fireplace, enjoying my coffee, typing away in my own world. Next to me, there's a man with special needs accompanied by another man. We sat next to each other for about 10 minutes with no interaction between the three of us or the two of them. Minutes later, an older man walks in, and the man with special needs is seemingly drawn to that man and reaches out his hand to him. I assume they know each other and we're meeting here. However, after the older man sits away from us after getting his coffee, it becomes clear that they don't know each other after all. The man with special needs keeps looking at the older man, so the older man decides to come join the pair while the man with special needs types on his tablet a message for the man. He simply writes, "Merry Christmas." This two-word message sparked an hour-long conversation among these strangers. As I sat there sipping my coffee and attempting to finish my paper, I couldn't help but eavesdrop on their conversation, learning about their lives, hearing their favorite stories about their families, their daily actions that start at 3 a.m. for one of the men. Yes, 3 in the morning. And the other pieces of wisdom they shared with one another. As I look around the coffee shop, many are immersed in their technology, succumbed to the stress of finals, working away with their heads down and headphones in. But these three men, who were all silently in their own worlds before, became acquainted by a simple Merry Christmas, and now their afternoon is filled with laughter and sharing pictures and stories from strangers. They even got each other's numbers and have plans to go ice fishing now. seems we all get so caught up in our responsibilities or are worried about chatting with others that we miss out on what this life is really about. Love, kindness, and making genuine connections with people. Many turn away from strangers or people who may seem to be different from them. But these three men, who are different in age, abilities, and walks of life, found so much in common and so much to bond about. So this holiday season, I encourage you all to take a step away from the devices and stress in your life and simply say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays to someone. You never know the kind of connections you may find.
And that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next week. Until then, I hope you have a very happy holiday.
It's always Christmas in my mind.